Welcome to Ever Beyond on Wolf Spirit Radio. Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond, 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 beyond.
Well, there's a nice sudden ending to my track. Good evening and welcome once again to Ever Beyond. I'm just going to adjust my microphone volume level so that we're not getting too distorted here. And tonight, my guest is Dave Patrick, who's been speaking to the Francis Bacon Society on Francis Bacon. And tonight we'll be going beyond bacon on Ever Beyond on Wolf Spirit Radio. Woo! Oh, that was supposed to go woo. Mind you. Never mind. Well, there you go. There was our. I thought I could hear that. I should be able to hear that, but oh well, maybe it didn't happen. Anyway, Dave, good evening. Welcome to Ever Beyond and welcome to the Ever Beyond studio. Here we are live in the studio.
Oh, well, thanks for inviting me back, Jeremy. It's good to be here.
You're very welcome. So, in our last conversation, we discussed how you got from Arthur Conan Doyle to Francis Bacon. How and then you started, you've written a book all about Bacon and the connections between Bacon and Conan Doyle. And now you're talking about bacon to the Bacon Society.
Mm.
And I won't make any jokes.
Yeah, well, it was a bit surreal, really. Because I think, as I said last time, after having done The View on Conan Doyle in 2009, that was to mark his 150th anniversary of his birth. He was born in Edinburgh in 1859, and that book went down very well, and my publisher came back and said, we'd like to do a follow-up, and I said, yeah, that'd be great. And he said, we'll do it in Sir Francis Bacon. I said, well, that'd be great, but who's Sir Francis Bacon? Because I genuinely had not heard of his name at all in February 2010. And from there, it was a very steep learning curve, but synchronicity played a huge part again, just as it did with the Conan Doyle book. And the upshot being, as you quite rightly said, I was invited to go and speak to the Bacon Society in London 20th September, just after the last show that I did with you. And it went down really well. And as we discussed earlier, I mean, I made it very clear that I was not going to speak as some informed expert academic on the subject, but really just to share all this kind of stuff that I'd come across on Bacon and even new stuff in Conan Doyle and the links between them, which were unexpected, and where it kind of led and really, you know, what it really points towards for now and all the things that are going on just now. And I think, you know, if we're looking at beyond bacon,
yes.
I mean, the big premise for the talk was, you know, is now the time for Bacon's hidden messages to be revealed? And of course, that begs the question, well, did he really have hidden messages? Where were they hidden? How were they hidden? The ciphers, the Shakespeare authorship question, etc., etc. And it was interesting, just before the talk to the Bacon Society, I got in touch with Peter Dawkins, who's a friend of mine. He's the director of the Francis Bacon Research Trust. And he's written a book on the Shakespeare authorship question. He's written other books on Bacon. He firmly believes that Bacon was the prime mover in terms of the Shakespeare works, or the works attributed to Shakespeare. Mm. And I said to Peter, I said, look, I said, there's two big questions that are kind of challenging me just now. I said, you know, one is, well, what was Bacon's big message? You know, what was his vital message, to use a kind of Conan Doyle words? Yeah. And is now the time for it to be revealed? And he said, well, that's interesting, Dave. He said, because, you know, I've been involved in this for, you know, 20, 30 years, and these questions kind of challenge me every day. And I thought, well, okay, if it's challenging Peter, then, you know, I'm kind of going in the right direction, but it's obviously, you know, an interesting, you know, challenging area. But as I said, all sorts of interesting synchronicities have been coming out. And if I can maybe just sort of jump to one of the things we spoke about was the, you know, the Mayan calendar.
Yep.
Now,
a great interest of many of our listeners here.
Well, of course. And, you know, irrespective of what dates we believe in, is it the 28th of October per Carl Kalaman and Ian Lungold and Barbara Han Clow, etc., or is it the 21st of December 2012 that seems to be the conventional wisdom, and does it really matter anyway? Now, interestingly, when I was checking on the Kalaman website, and for people that might want to check this out, it's kalaman.com, kalaman.com, and there's a very interesting page there on, I think it's called The History of Writing. And the first thing that leapt out at me was the final period that was being covered in his calendar to do with writing. Mm-hmm. And the period was 1617, the year 1617 to 2011. And I suddenly thought, wow, as I said, I was just looking at this out of interest, nothing to do with Bacon, or so I thought. But then when the year 1617 kind of popped out, I thought, well, hold on a minute. Bacon was, it was the year before he became Lord Chancellor. It was also, you know, right in the middle of his creative kind of period. It was also the year after William Shakespeare, the man, the actor, died as well. And 2011, and I thought, well, in very simplistic terms, could it be that from a Mayan calendar perspective, that seed had been planted and hidden away 1617, and it's now ripened to fruit in 2011? And there's some very interesting information about writing as well, and how writing had, I think he'd said that it was something that had been handed to us by the divine source, and it was a way of obviously capturing knowledge and keeping knowledge kind of alive in, you know, written form, and then of course you can look at how things can be coded and hidden away. Now, from a research point of view, there's obviously a huge paradox as well about hidden messages, because the one thing you would not get would be obvious sources of documentation saying, oh, this is what we did and this is how we did it and here you are.
Yeah.
Because the whole point of hiding was to make sure that you wouldn't find it kind of obviously. I suppose another interesting point of view was when I started to look into this whole coding side, I was actually quite amazed at the amount of work that had been done in this area, going way back to like 1850 and the 1880s, and people who'd spent their life researching this stuff and writing books and, you know, just putting everything on the line to try and follow this trail through, and then right up to the current day where we've got contemporary researchers like Mark Finnan, you know, looking at the Oak Island mystery, and another Norwegian guy I came across, Petter Amundsen, who's written a documentary film, or he's produced a documentary film called Sweet Swan of Avon, but unfortunately at the moment it's still in Norwegian and we're still waiting for the English version to come out. But you've got all these kind of strands that have been kind of interplaying through, and again, another bit of synchronicity was the day after I gave my talk. Sorry, it wasn't the day after. It was it was previous to going giving the talk to Bacon. But I spent a day at Bletchley Park, and I kind of wondered, code ciphers. I wonder if there's any help that could be given from any of the sources here. And I came across an interesting website, codesandciphers.org, which is written, or which is put together by a guy called Tony Sale. And I thought, oh, Tony Sale, he sounds like a good guy to get in touch with. You know, he might be able to help me with some of this decoding kind of challenge that I had. But unfortunately, just at the point when I was going to contact him, I had stumbled upon the fact in a paper that I picked up that he just passed away about 2 weeks after my visit.
Oh,
wow. Oh, God, that was a bit of kind of like negative synchronicity, if you like. But that was a very interesting visit, and I suppose it just kind of reinforced the point about, you know, coding and ciphers and how difficult it is to somehow penetrate. And it's not to do with intellectual kind of approaches. There's something to do with intuition in here as well. Everybody that's kind of working in this field seems to be finding their own truths in different ways. Whether we get to some kind of ultimate truth, well, I think the whole thing's starting to become revealed anyway. I mean, one of the things I said last time was, you know, in terms of the commonality between Arthur Conan Doyle and Sir Francis Bacon, they both stood for truth and justice.
Yeah.
And what are the huge issues that are coming up on the global platform at the moment?
Yeah.
Truth and justice.
Yeah.
Or, dare I say, the lack of truth that's coming out the establishment, out the governments, out the banking fraternity. Mm. And people are seeking justice.
It's
because
the greatest need for it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because we're now, the whole thing is being totally exposed from the grassroots up.
Mm.
You know, the whole Occupy movement, which we said we'd discuss a bit, and I can't say I'm an expert in it, but, you know, we're all following the kind of trends, and we know that certain people appear to have tried to co-opt the movement, and isn't it interesting that Obama's saying, oh, yes, I support it, but the point is that this is genuinely coming from the grassroots, so regardless of who's trying to co-opt it, it ain't going to work, and it's not going to go away. And the truth is becoming more and more revealed through people like Brian Gerrish, who I just watched his interview on the Alex Jones show, which was on Friday.
Oh, yeah.
Jim Mars, who's also interviewed Alex Jones, and Jim saying the New World Order is falling apart at the seams. And I thought, great, that's what we like to hear. Because we appear to be in a situation where the whole thing is becoming... It's almost like so ludicrous. I mean, I also heard just in the last couple of days from a couple of different sources, one of which was Brian Gerrish, and somebody else had mentioned it, about David Cameron standing up in Israel and saying his number one priority was Israel. And Brian Gerrish quite rightly said, well, if you're the UK Prime Minister, what the hell has Israel got to do with you?
Exactly.
You know, and so this whole thing, and you know, and this... working towards a staged event with Iran, you know, and what's all that about? And then you just start to piece the bits together about the banking system, the arms industry, the government, the vested interest, who gains from it all. But this is the interesting and exciting time, because it is all coming out into the open now. And I think what we're finding is that the people down the chain are themselves starting to wake up. You know, whether it's in the police force or the military or whatever, and they're starting to question, well, what are we really doing? Well, what, you know, what's it all about? And I believe that there was a big meeting by the British Constitution Group in London yesterday, and they were going to name names in the government, the judiciary, and police, etc. And basically the ultimatum was to say, look, we know the system's corrupt, we know you've been part of this corrupt system, we're naming you, it's your choice now. You either step over to this side and you're going to be on the side of the people, or you stay where you are and suffer the consequences. Now, that's a very interesting perspective. Now, if the whole thing goes completely haywire, you could end up with a French Revolution-type deal. Which I don't believe would actually happen, because there seems to be something in the psyche now at grassroots that whatever happens has got to be peaceful.
Yes,
that's why we've got
non-violent.
Exactly, the lawful rebellion. So that message has gone out there, because the powers that be, or as David Wolcott calls them, the power that were, are looking for excuses to impose martial law. You know, let's incite violence, and we can go in and say, right, you know, get the police in, get the military, whatever. I don't see that happening, because people are becoming so switched on now that they're using their common sense, but they're sharing the knowledge, you know, and the internet has obviously been a huge tool as far as that's concerned.
Yeah.
huge vehicle for sharing that media.
Absolutely. I believe it's the awakening of the global consciousness actually is the internet.
That's right.
The way, I mean, they use Facebook, you know, to spy on us, but we're using Facebook, and we have to be able to move faster than they. When I talk about we and they, you know, the people have to be able to communicate in a way that they understand a lot faster than the powers that be trying to interpret what they're saying. That's all going to take time. What are they doing? What's this tactic? Analysis, and by then it's too late. It's already happened.
Well, and I think the other interesting thing here is that the plan that they quote have, because it's, at the end of the day, it's all we. You know, we're allowing this world to have developed to this point in time. You know, maybe we've all got to waken up to this rampant materialism, I think, as we said last time, and just say, this is not the way.
Absolutely.
You know, we need more direct democracy, not some puppet government, you know, choose between Cameron or Clegg or Miliband or whatever. You know, it's like a choice, but it's no choice.
To me, you know, I don't follow politics much, and I look at these guys and I think, now, which one is he? there's that guy who looks like that, and there's that guy. They've all got the same face.
Well, it's sending almost the clones.
Yeah, telling me. I can't be done with it. A lot of shows that we've been doing here on Wolf Spirit Radio recently have been talking to native elders from Turtle Island. We call that America, yeah? And I really am feeling that they are in touch with the way humans should work with each other. You know, the Rainbow Council, where you represent everybody, the way that people... they're incredibly gently spoken. To the last one, none of them speak like me. I'm kind of like a foghorn. None of them speak like me. They're all very gentle, and they all speak from the heart. It's such a beautiful thing to hear, to be in contact with, and it's like this is part of the disclosure. There will never be David Cameron coming on TV saying, we were just joking about there weren't any ETs. Yeah, we've been talking to them for years, you know. That'll never happen, because it's not going to be them. If there were going to be any official announcements, they won't be happening until they're gone. And as far as I'm concerned, they're gone very soon.
I think you're right.
We'll see. And depending on how hard they resist, will be how graceful they go, in my humble.
I was going to say, from another mind perspective, Ian Lungold, who sadly passed away in 2005, but he'd done a lot of work in the mind calendar. And there's an excellent, there's several presentations on YouTube, but one I looked at, I found very interesting, because he was talking about the third last long period. I think started in something like 1755 through to...
So what would that be, sixth wave?
No, I think it was the seventh.
Seventh wave.
Yeah. But he said that was the power bit.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's the bit that's built up.
Industrial
and probably
power.
Still, exactly, yeah. And then the penultimate one, the eighth wave, was to do with ethics. And I think that's been very interesting, because that's really the big thing that's been coming up in the last few years. And, you know, thinking back to my friend Anita Roddick, bless her, I mean, the amount she did for ethics and not just business, but just world society generally.
Yes.
And really questioned, you know, what was going on. I mean, very much a groundbreaker.
Yes. For our listeners who may not know, Anita Roddick was the founder of The Body Shop, which was a cosmetics company that used all natural organic ingredients as far as they could and did all their ethical trading and fair trading with all the rest of the companies. Very much like the company that I work for, Aromantic, in Forest.
Nice plug.
Aromantic.co.uk. She's kind of set the standard for these things. And you can only just push that further into being, you know, as organic as you can get.
But the point, you know, in terms of the Ian Lungold progression of the waves, so we had power being the seventh, ethics being the eighth, mm-hmm. and then the final one, conscious co-creation.
That's right.
Which is wonderful, because what it means is that we know that things are going to collapse around us just now. Everybody's doing their bit in their own ways. I mean, I really, really applaud the people who are out in tents and the Occupy movements, whether it's in London, and I think it's interesting what's been brought up in St. Paul's, you know, and the big question, well, whose side would Jesus be on?
Exactly.
Well, it's pretty obvious.
Kick the tables over, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he'd be with the Occupy movement, you know, and it's great the fact that in the States, well, first of all, they realised that the focus must be on the banks, and then the next move is, it's got to be the central bank, it's got to be the Federal Reserve.
That's right.
Now, I think the big question in terms of this country is, because the Federal Reserve was set up in 1913, mm-hmm. The central bank in this country, the Bank of England,
that's
set up
the
by
model.
Exactly, set up in 1694 by William Paterson, mm-hmm. Scotsman. Now, there's big questions about the background to that, what's the agenda, who owns it, the whole thing about the City of London being a completely independent state within the UK, above UK laws, just as we have in
the Vatican
and District of Columbia in Washington, mm-hmm. you know, and the triangular relationship between those. So all these things are starting to become unravelled now. Mm. And of course, you've got the situation that's like the 99% and the 1%, which I think is a great slogan. I think it's actually probably 99.9% against 0.1%, to be honest, but it doesn't really matter. The people are realising that by coming together peacefully and, as I say, sharing this information, very much the Gandhi approach of non-violent rebellion, or whatever you want to call it, revolution.
Civil disobedience.
And it's shifting us. Mm. Because we're now questioning, why do we have to follow laws that are unfair? And laws that have been put in place to oppress.
Well, what we then start realising is that so-called laws aren't really laws at all, that they're commercial statutes.
Yes.
That only belong to the society to which you would belong if you contracted in.
Yes.
Now, they try to trick us to contract us in, saying, are you Mr. David Patrick, da-da-da? Mm. And you can say, that person isn't here. Mm. Because that person is your birth certificate, which is in your bedroom, in a little safe.
Yeah.
So we're starting to get wise to all their tricks and all of their lies.
Yes.
All of their lies. There is a new, this is a real new thing. I got this through Cliff High the other day, mm-hmm. is that there's a whole Russian academic movement that has been researching the facts of history, and they do it by writing analysis and almost completely rejected carbon dating. You know, it's completely unreliable. And they discovered that the Middle Ages, the period between naught and 1000 BC, didn't actually exist and was fabricated in order to present some kind of history, and that many things that were supposed to happen 2,000 years ago actually, in reality, only happened 1,000 years ago, and there's been no written evidence of anything whatsoever that was reliable before 1100.
So it's from year zero to 1000 AD, not BC.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
So the AD is only 1,000.
Well, funnily enough, somebody actually mentioned that to me just a few weeks ago, and it was from a totally separate source. And I just wondered. I thought, my goodness, that's interesting.
So I'm going to post the Mayan calendar thing by Ian Lungold on our Wisdom Base. On Wolf Spirit Radio, we have a Wisdom Base, which is like all these ideas that people have been putting in, new ideas about the way things are. Also, handy hints, things that can get you by. We're putting on the site under a blog series called The Wisdom Base.
Excellent.
And we'll put the Lungold thing, and I'll put a reference to the Russian guy
Swedish. Kalman.
No, Russian guy who just did this research about the Middle Ages.
Okay, yeah.
Anatoly Komenko. Something. Komenko, Mokenko. Don't know, Komenko.
Okay.
Whatever. Mm. So, meanwhile, back to bacon.
Back to bacon?
Now, I have a question regarding Mr. Bacon. In fact, this is from Tracy in Guelph, Ontario.
Wow.
One of our co-hosts. And she's interested in bacon as well.
Okay.
Why does the guest think Bacon's name was changed to Mr. Bacon, Mr. Bacon, shortly after his birth?
Well, Tracy, I have come across this, but I must admit I'm no expert in this side of things. I think this was some kind of device, and it was something to do with whether or not he was of royal lineage or not. Interestingly, as I said, I can't really answer that question, but when I gave the presentation to the Bacon Society in September, I mentioned that from the book The View Beyond and the chapter that Mark Harris and I wrote, and we used dowsing to ask, you know, a series of questions. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if I've mentioned this in the last program, but one of the stories about Bacon was that he was the illegitimate son of Elizabeth I and Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester.
This is a question, yes.
But when we doused, we discovered that, well, we did, when I say discovered, what results we got were that Dudley was indeed the father, but Elizabeth I was not the mother,
right.
Which kind of throws open some very interesting new questions. Now, when I mentioned this at the Bacon Society, I actually got a few nods from people, including James North, who was one of the contributors to The View Beyond. Mm-hmm. And James has actually been a scholar in the whole kind of Baconian sort of question, if you like, for a number of years. You know, he's been an academic researcher in that whole field. And I spoke to James afterwards, and he said, yeah, intuitively, he'd kind of felt the same kind of thing. So James and I are continuing to do some research together on this. So it's going to be interesting just to see what if anything comes out at the other end.
So I'm sorry. Interesting question.
Yeah.
It takes me back to what I was just talking about the corporate name.
Yeah. Yeah.
The corporate name is, for instance, Mr. David Patrick, or whatever your middle names are.
Well, I think there's definitely some sort of connection that goes back to Bacon's time, and probably John Dee's time and what have you, because one of the things that I haven't had a chance to kind of really look at too closely, and it's one of the kind of links you gave me about abledanger.net and the British East India Company, and going back to the year 1600, I believe, and the connection with, let's say, the British East India Company, and then Crown agents and how all that kind of connects that period then with what's going on now, with this, as you say, this kind of corporate identity of individuals.
Yes,
because a lot of this is quite new to me, and you know, people like John Harris at, I think it's TPUC.org.
Yes,
I forget what that stands for, but
the People's United Community.
Yeah,
Dean Clifford is another one. Explains the Freeman thing very well. Thank you, Anon.
Yeah.
Who are you, Anon?
So I don't know if Tracy can maybe sort of say any more from her perspective about what it means. Because I know I haven't answered the question. But yes, it's to do with some kind of device to differentiate between, as you say, the person, the flesh person, and the... what was it? The legal fiction, I think,
that's
is the
right,
term.
The legal fiction, or the straw man.
Yeah. Now, whether these terms were used in those days, I believe that a lot was kind of what's the word? It was kind of brought into the melting pot in these Elizabethan times, and it's only now that we're really starting to get the kind of resolution of it.
Yeah, because it's fruition of the basic recipe that they put together then.
Yeah, and it's back to what I said about 1617 and 2011.
Yeah.
You know, from the Mayan calendar. So it's interesting how all these things are kind of playing.
Yeah, so they may have known about the cycle of it. that by placing these things here, it'll all be ready by then, you know, by now.
Mm.
What do you think of the... have you investigated much more into his alchemy? Into the alchemy side of it? I mean, you were talking about the codes and ciphers. Alchemy, to me, is about distillation.
Yeah.
And concentration. What they're talking about, these different levels of concentration. And I'm wondering about the Mayan calendar, how that links, because as these different waves go by, their time space for things to happen become more and more concentrated until such a time as we have seven magnitude earthquakes, you know, every couple of months, whereas in times gone by, you wouldn't have one for 100 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Well, I think alchemy applies at different levels, you know, in terms of the earth, you know, earth energy lines, in terms of us as individuals, you know, we are supposedly, you know, being upgraded into light beings, you know, our DNA has been switched on and upgraded from two strands to whatever number you care to think of, whether it's 12 strands, 22, 24. I've heard that the number of DNA strands we have available to us is actually 144,000. Now, I mean, you know, it's very, very difficult to get your head around that. Or maybe the head is the wrong thing. You mentioned earlier about the heart.
Yes.
And this is what this is the period we're getting into now, where it's getting into the heart that's more important. And if I can just give another plug for The View, the first book, one of the subtitles of the... Of The View, apart from Conan Doyle to Conversations with God, in between we had Mind Over Matter, Heart Over Mind. In other words, the heart is the one that should be controlling, and the mind should be the tool of the heart.
Yes.
And this is what we're being asked to get into. And I actually quoted Drunvalo Melchizedek in the postscript to The View, because that's what he was saying in terms of his perspective of the Mayan calendar, that if we get into our hearts, then any kind of, you know, fear-based scenarios about earth changes, etc., they're not going to affect us because we're in the heart centre.
That's right.
And whatever happens, we'll just carry on and pass by.
The heart, being in the heart, allows you to flow with the times.
Exactly.
In fact, it's almost like no time. Yes.
Because it gets you in the now. Yes. That old spiritual cliche. Yep,
absolutely.
But it is true. Because it's the mind that starts to take us back into, oh my God, you know, I regret such and such in the past. Well, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
You know, just move on.
Even
you know,
yesterday.
Learn from it if you want. Exactly. And what's the point of worrying about the future? Because it might never happen anyway.
Mm.
You know, and I think the more that we start to focus, just like we're doing just now, just hopefully having a ball, and I hope people are enjoying listening as well, you know, just focus on the moment, give it just the best that you've got, and everything else take care of itself.
And be with the things that you love, that you that excite you, that give you a great pleasure. Yeah. Talking of pleasure, should we put on a track?
Yeah, that'd be great, Jeremy. Go for it.
Let's, because I need to refresh my tea. Which one were we going to start with? We're going to start with Mr. Dylan. Mr. Dylan. The times, they are a-changing.
How true. Wolf Spirit Radio.
Wherever you roam, can't admit that the waters around you have grown. And accept that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming, or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are changing. Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. Don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win. For the times they are a-changing. I'm senators, congressmen, please in the calm. Don't lock up the doorway, don't lock up the hall. He that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. There's a battle outside and it's raging. But soon set your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are changing. Throughout the land, don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out. You can't learn to hell, all your times, they are changing. Drawn and the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast. Is the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading. And the first one now will later be last. For the times, they are a-changing.
We're back. Good evening and welcome. This is November the 6th, 2011, and Ever Beyond is speaking with Dave Patrick. Good evening again. Welcome back.
Thanks, Shirley.
Sorry, I drove myself into a verbal cul-de-sac there, and I thought that's not the right thing to say, but I couldn't think of anything else to say. I get like that. I realise I'm slightly autistic. But
I thought you were artistic.
Yeah, well, a bit. I think I tried that. You can go, you can type into Google online autism test.
Uh-huh.
And apparently if you hit 34... score of 34, you're pretty autistic, but I'm 24.
Yeah.
You know, most people are about 17 or something like that. So between 17 to 34, there's the autistic spectrum. So I think they call me quite high functioning.
Right. Genius.
Well, I'm sub-genius. My IQ is really funny. My IQ and my son's IQ are exactly the same in terms of the ISEC method. It's 135, and 140 is supposed to be genius. So I'm just riding below the radar. Just not quite genius enough. Genius enough to run a radio station, though.
Great.
And that's what we need, because we need to get the messages out. So, bacon. Time. Mayan calendar. Where should we take off from there?
Well, I think then back to Bacon. I mean, one of the things I speculated on, because I think you've got to speculate, is how these groups actually worked in the Elizabethan times. I mean, given the fact that we were working in secret, I mean, you ask the question, well, why were they working in secret, and what were they trying to achieve? And I mean, from my kind of relatively limited knowledge, my gut feel is definitely that William Shakespeare the Man did not write the Shakespeare plays. I think that would really have been impossible. And I think it's just a load of vested interests who are keeping that kind of myth going. Because otherwise the Stratford and Avon kind of whole story would dissolve.
Yeah.
My feeling is that they were groups that were involved in putting this together, and not necessarily the same group at each time period. I think the groups would have mixed up, but I think a bit like the translation of the King James Bible, I think it was 1611 that came out, and that was written definitely by different groups. I think there were some like 54 different groups, and they all took sections, and each group came up with a translation of each section, and then they were compared. Well, I think Bacon was the guy who finally pulled that all together, and actually probably coded a lot of stuff into the Bible itself, and some of which seems to have been kind of revealed. And I think similarly with the Shakespeare plays, because what you've got to remember is that the times there were so different from now. I mean, that's kind of stating the bleeding obvious, as Basil Fawlty would say, but it very much was, a dangerous time in those days, because you had such power from the monarchy, you had the whole Catholic Protestant Reformation thing going on, and the kind of Gnostic kind of underground kind of movements. And you had to be very, very careful what you said to whom about what.
Yeah.
Or you could quite literally get your head chopped off, I think, as I said before. And so... kind of lost the thread here a bit, but I think what Bacon realised was that something had to change to get away from this endless bloodshed that was going on, because it was very much tit for tat. You know, the Protestants and Catholics, whether the English monarchy were on the Protestant side or the Catholic side, because you had, Henry VIII excommunicated from the Vatican, and then going to the Church of England, then Bloody Mary came on the throne, tried to revert to Catholicism, then you had Queen Elizabeth coming on, paranoid about whether the Catholics were going to be after her, because seemingly there was a warrant, for her from the Catholic side, and she was pursuing the Protestant, momentum. At the end of the day, these are all institutionalised religions with a lot of power. that was vested in them. So you had this kind of complete maelstrom of like competing stuff going on. And I think Bacon and the whole kind of Rosicrucian kind of movement, I think that what was recognised, and this was coming from John Dee as well, we said we kind of touch on Dee and say, I'm no expert in Dee either, but I think what Dee recognised was the kind of thing we talk about quite openly now. We did not need the power of the priesthood to make contact with the divine. Yeah. We actually have that ability ourselves, and it's back to our heart centres. We can contact through our heart centre, through our right brain as well, which is the creative side as well, through meditation, through other kind of ritual, that connection can be made. Now, I believe that John Dee, he developed certain rituals, some of which were maybe a bit questionable, you know, when you look at the Enochian invocations and contact with angels and what kind of entities was he really kind of contacting, etc. But, you know, when I tried to imagine Bacon with these groups, I couldn't imagine a room full of people, and it wouldn't just be men either, there'd be women involved as well. There's people like Mary Sidney, who was married to the Earl of Pembroke, and, you know, and her sons were acknowledged on the front cover of, or certainly the front sleeve of the 1623 Shakespeare Folio edition. You know, so there's all sorts of connections there, and she led the Wilton Circle, and there are certain people who believe that Mary Sidney was the true author of the Shakespeare plays. Now, again, we've got the movie Anonymous that's just come out, which unfortunately I haven't seen yet, because I don't think it's been shown in this area. But it came out, interestingly, on the 28th of October, and it's pushing the kind of scenario that it was actually the Earl of Oxford, Edward de Vere, who was the real author of the Shakespeare plays. You know, so you've got all this kind of, you know, stuff going on. I mean, be that as it may, I think what these groups would have done would have been using what I would call like divine inspiration, very much like the kind of Victorian seance type of approach. Again, this is pure speculation, but in a sense, you know, using meditation, using kind of like trance-like techniques to, in another way of saying it, is getting to alpha level state, brain state, to get into that kind of, you know, let's say trance-like situation. Whether they were taking substances to help them do this or not, that's another open question.
Might be involved there.
Well, it could well be. And then, you know, this information was then taken down and then scribed. So it wasn't a left brain intellectual exercise that created those plays. And then, of course, you've got the codes and the ciphers. And as I said, I was completely amazed by the number of people who've already been working in the field. And you seem to have like overlays of different ciphers as well. You know, you can look at them at all sorts of different levels. Then, of course, you've got the naysayers who say, oh, no, it's all rubbish, you know, that there's nothing coded at all. So we still have this kind of situation. I think another interesting thing in terms of the Shakespeare authorship question is that, whereas before it was kind of like taboo to even question in academic circles who wrote Shakespeare, because of course the academics said, well, it was quite obvious that Shakespeare wrote Shakespeare, that's it, end of story, no discussion. And there's actually a guy I came across, and I quoted in my presentation, a guy called Professor Stanley Wells, who just happens to be I think he's the chairman of the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust, so kind of like no vested interest there. But he said quite categorically, I have not come across any serious Shakespeare scholar who has questioned whether William Shakespeare wrote the Shakespeare plays.
Not serious Shakespeare scholars, but obviously be academics who are paid by
So when you look at it and you think, well, what he's basically saying is that anybody who challenges it, it's not a serious Shakespeare scholar.
Exactly.
You end up in this kind of complete,
tautology,
Yes. So, So I believe that what Bacon in particular saw, and his groups, was, you know, they were living in this foment of stuff that was going on. You know, people like the Earl of Essex, you know, ended up being beheaded and because he tried to mount an uprising against Queen Elizabeth, who may or may not have been his mother, and there's all sorts of stuff going on there. So it's a horrible kind of time. And so I think what they saw were probably two things working together. One was the power of the monarchy and the church, which was actually causing a lot of this problem. You know, you had this divine right of kings and queens and whatever. And I think what Bacon was saying, whether or not he was actually of royal lineage, I don't think that's necessarily important in this case, but I think he basically said, you know, we are all kings, we all have that potential, and from a spiritual point of view, we are all equal. We're all at different stages of development, but everybody should have an equal opportunity for spiritual development in their lifetime. And I think on the other side of the coin, he also recognised that the masses, in the main, were pretty ignorant, because there was no formal education system. And that's why Bacon said, you know, he would take all knowledge to be his province. And he also recognised that knowledge is power. And of course, that's been trotted out, it's quite a cliche now. Now, again, knowledge is power can be taken two different ways. One is, knowledge is power, so therefore we are the elite, and we have this knowledge, and we're going to keep it to ourselves, and we're going to do what the hell we like to the detriment of the rest. We're going to keep the masses ignorant. And, you know, just work in secrecy. And I think, as we were saying during the break, I believe, if we're talking about the Illuminati, I honestly believe that there are at least two different strands,
entities
called the Illuminati, and I think one of the problems is that they kind of get confused. Now, one is the Bavarian Illuminati, Adam Weishaupt, and you know, what was formulated in 1776, just at the time of the American Revolution, but that went further back than then. There's no doubt about it. But to me, that's what I'd call a kind of man-made Illuminati. That this was the controlling elite who had this kind of wisdom. Whether or not they were working with other entities or whatever, I don't know, but that's the agenda that has been forwarded from, you know, what we recognise as being the 13 Illuminati families, you know, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, the Bushes, the Clintons, etc. And they're the ones who are desperately trying to develop the New World Order, which in fact is the kind of like the old world order, just, you know, reigning in all their power. And if you look at Illuminati, I mean, you know, the enlightened ones, I think there is also an organization, or whatever you want to call it, Illuminati, who are truly enlightened beings who are actually working for the benefit of the planet and for the benefit of everybody. And I think Bacon was in that latter group because he quite clearly said that he wanted to create a social revolution which is going to benefit everybody. And if you look at the New Atlantis as being the kind of model, and I wrote about this in my own chapter in The View Beyond, because I posed a very obvious question. Well, you know, the New Atlantis, if that's a template for a utopian, what was to become the United States of America, why has it gone so horribly wrong? And also, interestingly, they spoke about this island of Bensalem being a land where they didn't need to use money, which, again, was very interesting. And so, as I said, I think with these real illumined ones, what he was also saying was that in terms of government, I mean, it would be government of the people, but it would be, you know, true scientists and philosophers who, you know, with the knowledge to govern, but govern in a kind of fair way, and it would be a meritocracy.
Yeah.
And people would kind of recognise that, and everybody could work within that kind of system, because they know that the people who are governing were part of the people and deserved. It's more network rather than hierarchical as well.
Exactly. It's the flat file. It's the egalitarian.
Yeah. And I mean, something else it kind of links back to. I mean, you know, you go back to Atlantean times and you're probably aware of the Sons of the Law of One and the Sons of Belial. Because we're kind of in that kind of situation now.
Yeah.
And the service to self and the service to others is Wolcock and
it's,
others.
Well, it's what
about.
My teacher always used to call simply the White Lodge and the Dark Lodge.
Yeah.
And members of the White Lodge and members of the Dark Lodge are part of the Illuminati. In fact, they're part of every organisation all over the world. In the CIA, there are White Lodge people, and they call them White Hats in the CIA and FBI. Yeah. And, you know, there are people who are working for the benefit of all in these groups, knowing full well that they walk a very thin line because they could be found out and dealt with, as it were, by the fellas.
But
so
I was just going to say, interesting, going back to Conan Doyle, in his channeling through Grace Cook and what was written about in the book Return of Arthur Conan Doyle by Ivan Cook, these were the channelings in 1931 and 32 we spoke about last time, after he physically passed on in 1930. Now, what Conan Doyle said was very interesting. He said that it wasn't really a case of good and evil as such. You kind of needed both to be working against each other. And it was the two kind of, almost like two wheels, and it was like the sparks that were being created by them that were actually supporting human evolution. So it's not like, the thing is, you know, unless you've got the dark, you can't see the light, and all this stuff.
And without friction, you cannot polish anything.
So, we're definitely reaching a point here where we have this kind of, it is almost like an end game for this time, you know, between light and dark, and just as I'm saying, there's two kind of like, well, at least two probably Illuminati groups. There's also two plans on the go as well, and simply put, one is the divine plan, which is not been organised by us humans, but we can play a part in this. And then there's the what you might call the Dark Hat plan or the New World Order, and it's like these two plans are kind of converging towards. Well, they're already converging now, and we're actually seeing it. I think next year is going to be the real kind of, I don't know, quite
we're
what's
going to happen.
We're
seeing the beginning of it right now.
Yes.
We're seeing all of this stuff that's going on, financial collapse. We know that that's part of their plan, to collapse the financial system and then say, hey, we got this great new money, or hey, we got these great new cards. Or, hey, all you need to do is have this chip inserted into your brain, and then we'll control you. I mean, we'll allow you to get food. You just have to walk past the scanner.
Yes.
You don't need to get money out of your pockets. No need to carry money. How safe is that? Everything's personalised, tied to your DNA. Oh, well, we've got to take a sample. Don't mind this. It won't hurt much. And then everybody is a brainwashed sheeple. And, you know, but people are starting to get wise to these tricks, because they're one of the things I wanted to say is that, you know, you're saying knowledge is power.
Yeah.
One of the things that they have is patents.
Yeah.
Patents are a form of knowledge and a great deal of power, because if you have a patented device, you can have that license. You can. There goes the cat. you can have a patent licensed and you can use that patent for your personal gain if you're a patent lawyer, for instance.
Yes.
For instance, there was a secret patent that was actually controlling aeroplanes. This is the QRS-11 chip, which allows you to actually take over an aeroplane remotely. And nobody knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
I only found out when the volcanic ash cloud came over Iceland, and they discovered that there was this volcanic ash advisory service, which is more than just an advisory service. They're actually able to take a joystick and move your plane out of the way. Nobody knew that could happen, but all of the jets, including the jets that hit the Twin Towers, all of the jets are able to be remotely controlled. And you know who knew about this? You know who the patent lawyer was this? Hillary Clinton.
Oh, surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise. Mm. There she is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, patent lawyers. Mm. So there's knowledge as power.
Yeah.
On a really practical basis. They use secret technologies. When they do these false flag things, they use secret technologies.
Yeah.
Mm. Like with the Titanic, they are able to kill a lot of the opponents to the Fed.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, well, two things I'd pick up on there. I mean, the Titanic thing, I mean, I just stumbled across relatively recently, in probably in the last year or two, about the three bankers who were kind of taken out because they opposed the Fed.
Mm.
And it was a crime so huge that nobody would ever suspect. You know, very similar to 9/11. But there's also, you know, we're talking about Abel Danger earlier, and when you actually listen to
David Hawkins.
David Hawkins and Field McConnell.
Yeah.
And they talk about the Crown Agents and FemComp, is it?
FemComp Inc., yes.
FemComp Inc.,
yeah.
I mean, you know, even...
It is unbelievable
information because you're listening, you're listening to this stuff and you think, can this possibly be true? Well, I mean, I can't say one, but
let's just explain a bit what we're talking about. If people go, I've put a link to abledanger.net. It is incredibly complicated to get through. Dave and I have been listening to their radio shows on occasion on a Wednesday on Rail and Allen Rumour Mill News radio, and they have been basically picking apart the networks of different guilds, ancient guilds, they're called honourable guilds or something, worshipful guilds, that's right.
Yeah.
Worshipful guilds that all exist within the City of London that are connected to all different trades. So, for instance, there's the Worshipful Guild of Master Carpenters, the Worshipful Guild of Toilet Cleaners. You know, they, every single job that's done, there's a guild. And these guilds are controlled from the City of London. And they form networks all over the world, and they form networks that are buried deep into the infrastructure of all countries, and particularly things like the Fed and the American government. And there is this other group. Now, this is an interesting one. Is the FemComp Inc.
Yeah.
And what he says is that it's called FemComp. Not because it's like a compilation, but these are women who have been compromised, who have been compromised, and once they're into it, they kind of acquiesce to it and then start compromising other people. And these are the people who are able to pull out a photograph that any politician might not want to be made public. They have a big file base of videos and photographs of people in power in a compromising position. Presumably, they also did the compromising. You know, they were seductresses and things like that. So it's very likely that that woman that got the World Bank guy into trouble would be one of these women. Who was he?
Well, the IMF guy. Dominic Strauss-Kahn.
Strauss-Kahn, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So those are the old tricks. And I think we should have a little break, and then after the break we'll bring in Tracy, shall we?
Sounds good.
Okay. This is The Who, and they won't get fooled again, will you?
Thank you.
Speaking with Dave Patrick and now Tracy Kennedy. Welcome, Tracy.
Thank you so much for bringing me on, Jay. Hello, Dave. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing fine, Tracy. Good to meet you.
A pleasure.
So, where were we? Two Illuminatis and white hats and dark hats, what I call the White Lodge and the Dark Lodge. What's news, Tracy, from Guelph?
Well, from Guelph, we're just wondering, and I think if we as, personally my questions, the whole book of Utopia, I would love this to be true. I would love it to happen at least just once. Do you think Bacon wrote this? Think it was his thought?
What, the book Utopia?
Yeah.
Well, that was Thomas Moore. I think it was Thomas Moore, but that's quite a bit before Bacon. Bacon's utopian book was New Atlantis, which is a fictionalized account of an island called Bensalem, which could have been linked to travels in Peru or Japan. I mean, not Bacon. This is sort of second-hand information. They used this as a kind of device, but the New Atlantis was published purportedly posthumously. Bacon, well, this is something we haven't gone into, but he physically passed away in 1626 at the age of 65. But there's a school of thought that being a kind of ascended master, that he faked his death and disappeared off the continent, worked on for decades, and then, you know, came back as Saint-Germain, and, you know, be that as it may. So, yeah, getting back to the point, Tracy, it was New Atlantis that was Bacon's utopian vision. And, yeah, it's interesting that, you know, there have been a lot of utopian scenarios developed. I mean, people like, what's his name, New Lanark, Robert Owen, he created the New Harmony settlement in Indiana. And unfortunately, with a lot of these things, you know, the great visions, but very seldom seem to work because people get in the way.
What was that, Tracy?
Oh, I was just saying that we all wish for peace.
Well, that's absolutely right. And the only way we're going to get peace is back to what we said earlier about truth and justice, that we've got to have a society. And I say we, I mean, we're all in this together. I mean, what we call the black hats and the white hats or whoever, you know, we're all bits of the source, if you want to put it that way. We're all on a kind of spiritual journey, whether we like it or not, or whether we're aware of it or not. And this is what I was saying about conscious co-creation, that we're reaching this point where things are falling apart. I mean, they're going to fall apart anyway. And it's up to all of us to start, you know, looking at ways to benefit the planet. If I can maybe just share one thing with you, I don't know if I've mentioned this in the last show, I don't think so, but out of the blue, I had a meditation a few years ago, and it was, you know, it was just so profound. It was like over one night, there was this kind of like silvery dust settled over the planet, and people woke up the next morning and they just said, I'm not going to go to work today, it's pointless. What's the point in just going to working 9 to 5, something I don't like? And they were phoning up their friends and saying, look, I'm not going to go to work today. What can we actually do that's going to benefit the planet, actually make things better for everybody? And I thought that was really quite, you know, profound. And that's the world we're working towards, where we don't get tied up in these myths about, you know, there's too many people on the planet, we can't feed everybody and all this. It's all contrived nonsense. You still there, Tracy?
Yep.
Yeah, so with you there. When we had the blackouts in Ontario a couple of years ago, it was awesome here. It was awesome. People actually went outside and it was like they were scratching their eyes. Mm. We had block parties. The electricity wasn't working. People made barbecues and we all got in the pools and met each other again. And for a minute, and I have to admit, still now, I was thinking, this is humanity. Is this not a cue of, why don't we just continue this? Because here, it was lovely.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
It was really lovely.
And you just said the word there, love. It's back to this choice we have, love or fear, and why wouldn't we choose love?
Exactly.
You know, and that's and this is back to the heart center bit, because fear, all, you know, fear affects the mind, but once you're in the heart, it can only be love, and that's what's got to guide us. And it's not always easy. You know, we all kind of fall off the train every so often. We know what we should be doing, but that's part of the human experience.
Yeah. We made mistakes. I was wondering, it's kind of off topic from what you've gone on, but...
Nothing's off topic. We're covering everything.
Francis Bacon's name was changed to Mister.
Yeah.
When he was 6 months old. What's your thoughts on that? Do you think he could have been the Queen's illegitimate son?
Well, I was going to say we kind of covered that earlier, but I didn't actually answer the question because I don't really know. What I was discussed with Germany was that in the book The View Beyond, which I edited, which covered Bacon, and for people who want to check out the book, it's called The View Beyond, Sir Francis Bacon, Alchemy, Science, Mystery, and it's published by Polaire Publishing, January 2011. But when I was writing my chapter, I got a dowser friend of mine to collaborate, because we're looking at two aspects. One was the New Atlantis and where that had all gone, and also looking at buried treasure. So we use dowsing to ask questions, not just about treasure, supposed treasure locations at Bruton Vault in Virginia and Oak Island in Nova Scotia, but we also looked at family constellations around Bacon. And what we came up with, when I said we, there were actually four of us in the kind of dowsing group, and individually we each came up with the result that although the kind of story went that Elizabeth I and Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester, could have been the legitimate or the real parents of Francis Bacon, we doused and we came up with Robert Dudley being the father, but Elizabeth I was not the mother. And that kind of lays open some really interesting questions. And what was also interesting was that when I shared this at my talk at the Francis Bacon Society on the 20th of September, and I'm not sure if you're aware, but the Francis Bacon Society has been on the go since 1886. It was set up by a Mrs. Henry Potts in 1886, and set up to really kind of look at Bacon's work, you know, research it, and also research it from the perspective of the Shakespeare authorship question as well. But one of my contributors to The View Beyond, James North, who's a well-known and well-respected Bacon academic, he nodded his head, and, you know, when I spoke to him, he said, yeah, he'd kind of intuitively come up with that same kind of conclusion. So James and I are looking into that together. We haven't really done much since we've kind of agreed on that, but it's like watch the space, you know, something interesting may develop out of it. But as I say, I can't really answer that initial question about, you know, the mister and what have you. You probably know more about it than I do, Tracy.
I probably don't. It's a question, and I love puzzles, and there are pieces missing, so...
Well, that's what I said in my presentation. It's a pity I couldn't do the presentation on the radio. Unfortunately, it's a visual presentation in the main, but...
Maybe we could make a video out from it.
Well, we certainly could, yeah.
You know, just talk over it, yeah.
Yeah. Well, one of the things on that, the presentation at the Bacon Society was actually videoed from a mobile camera, and we're looking at how we can kind of splice the video with the slides to come up with something. So we haven't quite cracked it yet, but I'd love to be able to share that with a wider audience.
Oh God, that would be lovely. The whole question goes into my mind now, how rules were changed after Francis Bacon was born, on how natural children could ascend the throne. And recently, there's been the whole question on how firstborn female children can ascend the throne in Britain. And it kind of looks like there's a girl coming in the royal family again. So it made me question. It's a puzzle.
So what you're saying, Tracy, is that the next monarch will be a queen rather than a prince.
Yes, I do.
Yes, king.
I believe that.
Interesting.
Because the rules have been changed out of the blue for no reason. Someone has a reason. I don't get it, but there's a reason, because they probably knew it was coming.
And they plan their things long in advance.
Yeah, and maybe we need a woman. We do, I think, but from this line...
Not a Habsburg, no.
Or a Gotti Saxburg.
We've had enough Germans running everything, and they're lovely people, but it hasn't worked out. So
hasn't quite worked out, that's true.
Well, I mean, from my own perspective, I mean, I've always felt that the royal family's been a bit of an anachronism in this country. And
sorry.
It's interesting. I think I maybe mentioned it. I was at the Braemar gathering in September, and of course the Queen was there with the royal party, and the MC was trying to get everybody to say, you know, God save the Queen, and there was very, very little response from the crowd. Now, you wouldn't have had that 10 years ago. And I thought that was an interesting indication of how things are changing.
And there's also been a very interesting development in the Pope, because he had this big gathering, you know, everybody come to the Vatican, I got something to tell you. And there are a very large number of bishops and cardinals who publicly, blatantly shunned him by walking past and looking away and not shaking his hand,
mm-hmm.
or kissing his
mm-hmm.
ring,
mm-hmm.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a shunning going on, and this is part of the change that we're talking about, is that powers that be are not any longer cohesive. They don't support each other. They're like a bunch of rats in a sack.
Mm.
Yeah.
Rats sinking. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know if we mentioned before Michael Sarrian and the Brotherhood of Death, and his work is fantastic. Yeah, he'd pieced together the monarchy, the Vatican, and Freemasonry. Mm. And when you start to look at the kind of stuff that's been going on, it kind of all kind of makes sense once you start seeing the patterns. Once you connect the dots and see the patterns, of course it's very easy to get carried away in all this conspiracy theory, as they call it. But I mean, as Ian R. Crane, who is somebody else I follow, might be worth just saying, the kind of people that I do kind of have a lot of respect for and time for that I follow. Max Kaiser on the banking front, because Kaiser is an ex-Wall Street insider. He knows what he's talking about.
Yes.
I love his humour as well, and Stacey Herbert as well. So for people who are not tuned into that, Russia Today,
brilliant.
3 days a week it comes out. If you want the inside track and the banking scams that are going on. Alex Jones Channel, Texan radio host. Now, Alex is pretty direct and in your face. I think he has got a good heart, but I think what's important about Alex is the calibre of the interviewers he gets on his show. And, for example, Birgitta Jónsdóttir, the Icelandic MP, that's how I first made contact with her, was after seeing her on Alex Jones. And interestingly, she was interviewed in Max Kaiser just 2 or 3 days ago.
Mm.
Well worth watching that. Ian R. Crane, like myself, ex-oilfield employee. He worked for Schlumberger, I worked for Shell.
Mm-hmm.
And
he worked for Schlumberger?
Yeah.
Same as David Hawkins?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if they knew each other or whatever, but he became aware of what was going on in the first Gulf War. So I've got a lot of time for Ian. He's worked very closely with Jim Corr in the Irish situation, the Irish banking scam. Things that have been going on that I only became aware of fairly recently, like the fluoridisation of the Irish, I'm talking about the Republic of Ireland, water supply since the 1960s.
Really?
Absolutely incredible. And are you Canadian, Tracy?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, I don't know what the sort of water supply situation is like in Canada, but no doubt you've had moves.
The city, it's different. I live in a little cul-de-sac of a city where we allow none of that.
You allow none of that?
No.
Good.
Doesn't happen. There is no spraying of our weeds. There is none of that happening here. We have hydrogen peroxide, and that's what cleans our water here in Guelph.
And so it should be. Ozone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's a big thing you just brought up. Why do you think Ireland is so attacked? It's been attacked forever. Pretty much every invading army first goes to Ireland and gets their bottoms handed to them, usually.
Mm.
But everything that's happened in Europe goes to Ireland first.
Well, I think Ireland's got a special place. I mean, again, I'm no expert in this, but I can just share things I've picked up. Michael Tessarian is Irish by background. He's done a lot of research into, especially the Irish-Egyptian link, and it seems like a lot of the kind of ancient wisdom and what have you has actually come out of Ireland, not out of Egypt.
Well, he's saying that the Atlantean went to Ireland and then went to Egypt.
Yeah, yeah. And you've also got a friend of mine, Veronica Keane, and we mentioned this in the last show, the MontagueKeane.com website.
Right.
And Monty Keane died in 2004, but he channels to Veronica every week, and it comes out on the website. So there should be a a message coming out tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I'm sure Veronica won't mind me mentioning this, because she mentioned it at the Francis Bacon Society meeting. Mm. This is a bit of a showstopper to finish with. This may or may not happen. This is according to Veronica.
Yeah.
She says the global... this is the information she gave on the 20th of September. Mm-hmm. She said the global monetary system, banking system, is going to collapse on the 11th of November. 11-11-11. Mm-hmm. And Saint-Germain is waiting in the wings with a completely new system to take over. Mm-hmm. Now, it'll be interesting to see whether or not that happens. But all I'm saying is that's what we got from Veronica. Now, Veronica is from Ireland, mm-hmm. so she knows a lot about what's going on in the background. There's more to Ireland than meets the eye, we know that. And there's something about interdimensional portals there. And that's one of the reasons why the North and the Republic have actually been split into two different countries. The North has been held on by the UK because there's some kind of special significance to the counties in the North.
Yeah, it's probably the portals there.
And it's to do with portals, and that's all I can say, because I don't know... Yeah. what they are or where they are or whatever. But
they'll
be
behind military fences, no doubt.
Yeah.
Something like that. So we've got 3 minutes left.
Yeah.
Tracy, do you have any last words before we...
Last words? Love to talk to you boys again. Thank you so much, Dave. I would love to talk to you, both of you again.
Okay. Well, okay. I can put you in touch on Facebook and...
please do.
Excellent.
Thank you so much. Great show, guys. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Tracy.
Thank you very much, Tracy. And Dave, so you'll be off on more gigs. You're going to be doing any more lectures?
Well, it's interesting that having done the presentation at the Bacon Society, I realised that it could be adapted for presentations anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And I actually gave a presentation up in Dingwall, up in just north of Inverness, for those who don't know this area, last week. So I used the same slides, but I adapted, you know, my talk to a different audience, and it went down really well. And I would love to find ways to just share this information out.
Website? Yes.
Have I got a website?
Have you got a website?
No.
How do people get touch with you?
Email.
By name?
dave@healthyenterprise.com.
Healthyenterprise.com.
Or through Facebook. Mm-hmm. And I've got a page on Facebook which is worth looking at. It's called The Vital Message.
So Dave Patrick on Facebook. Inverness.
Inverness?
Nairn.
Nairn. Speaking of interestingly, today I was at a car boot sale in Nairn, mm-hmm. and a couple came up to me and we started discussing this kind of stuff, if you like, and he mentioned the fact that there have been chemtrails across Nairn and the Murray Firth just in the last sort of few days and weeks.
Really?
Yeah, and very, that's interesting, because that's not something I'd associated with this part of the country.
Not at all.
So we'll be looking at chemtrails up in...
Certainly will be. Mm-hmm. So, as we're coming to the end of our 90 minutes. I'll just bring in the theme tune here. Dave Patrick, thank you very much. This has been Ever Beyond. Next week, who knows? I don't know. Let's see. Well, I think we're going to do something more about frequencies. I'm pretty certain of that. Until that time, beyond. Let's go ever beyond. Good night.